Hi, it's Fraser here. Before we kick off with this week's Spike podcast, I just wanted to let you know about an incredibly exciting event we've got coming up on Monday. To mark the publication of Brendan O'Neill's brilliant new book, A Heretic's Manifesto, we'll be hosting an online book launch. And if you're a Spike supporter, you can attend for free. Brendan O'Neill will be interviewed by the brilliant Andrew Doyle live on Zoom at 7 p.m. on Monday. If you're a Spike supporter, then you can claim your ticket right now by going to the online supporters hub. But if you're not a Spike supporter yet, then now is the perfect time to sign up. You'll not only get access to this event, plus all other events in the future, you can unlock all kinds of other exclusive perks, from ad-free reading to being able to access the comments section. It really is worth signing up. To find out more, just go to spiked-online.com/support. That's spiked-online.com/support. See you at the event. Hello and welcome to the Spiked podcast. Back with me as ever, we have Spiked's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And we're delighted to have in the studio an extra special guest, Spiked columnist and stand-up comedian, Simon Evans.
Afternoon.
Coming up on today's show, the persecution of Kathleen Stock, the Philip Schofield scandal, and the absurdity of the UK's COVID inquiry. So Kathleen Stock spoke at the Oxford Union this week. She's a gender-critical feminist, philosopher, probably one of the most reasonable people out there, I think it's fair to say, on the gender issue. And yet, there were massive protests. She needed security to turn up. Someone glued themselves to the floor of the Oxford Union chamber. I mean, Simon, what the hell is going on? I mean, all she seems to
And yet, like, almost insultingly, when I last spoke at the Oxford Union, there was nothing. No kind of hostility, no protest at all.
You're so much worse than she is.
Disgraceful. I've really got to raise my profile. Maybe this podcast will be the opportunity. I agree with you. I don't think she's just reasonable. I also think she's extraordinarily lucid and rational. And I read her book, Material Girls. I've tried to do a little bit of deeper reading away from just blogs and tweets on the trans issue. And that was by far the most coherent, systematic explanation of what's gone on, why, whom it might benefit, what the hidden agenda might be, and also, you know, where we might go from here. I just thought there was not an ounce of hatred. And I'm not claiming that I am not remotely partisan myself. I am. I have, you know, views, of course, and prejudices and biases. But I do know when I'm reading something that is fueling them and when I'm reading something that's actually calming me down. And she was very much the latter. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think it's bizarre. The only thing I do think is, of course, that she was herself expelled from a university, or I think ultimately decided to leave because her position there had become untenable. I know that because, of course, it was my local university, Sussex. And perhaps that fact in itself has branded her as a toxic proposition in university spaces, whereas perhaps if she'd arrived, I don't know, from some more, you know, neutral position in the private sector, she might not have already, you know, they may not already have made their minds up.
And Tom, this is, you know, part of a long-running problem of no platform. Mm-hmm. It's been particularly vexed around the trans issue. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that aspect of this?
Well, I was just quite struck by the fact that this is probably the Oxford Union's biggest scandal since they invited David Irving and Nick Griffin back in 2007.
Wow.
Huge protest. Then it was a national media story. This time around, you could arguably say there was the reaction was more extreme in some quarters. You had the Oxford Students Union break ties formally with the Oxford Union, which I think, if not the first time that's ever happened, it certainly doesn't happen very often. There were obviously all these protests. The Prime Minister intervened at one point. Mm. And yet, this is not about sticking up for the right to speak of genuinely extreme and hateful people, as it was in the case of 2007. And I think that says a lot about where the free speech debate has moved. That's partly because of the fact that having failed to stick up for the extremes, you are ill-equipped to even stick up for the moderates. But I think it also speaks to a peculiar dynamic which exists specifically around the trans issue, but not exclusively to it, which is that it's now the majority position which is demonised. Mm. And that's an odd position to find yourselves in. Usually the mainstream can kind of look after itself. But because on this issue, and many others, I think it's fair to say, the eccentric position, which is to say that biological sex doesn't exist, which is to treat anyone with even reasonable concerns as fire-breathing bigots and so on, they somehow have managed to capture the conversation, set the terms of the debate. And that's a relatively unusual thing, when usually the lot of the free speech absolutists is sticking up for the nutcases. And that's certainly not the issue with someone like Kathleen Stock.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Free speech as an issue has, of course, as we observed, swung around hard over the last, I mean, it used to be in the 60s, Berkeley University, I think, was like the home of free speech, demanding it. Leftist rebellion, revolution, critique of government policy and so on had free speech. Free speech is always defended or demanded, rather, by those who are who suddenly feel like they've lost traction and suddenly ranks close. And it's always a sign that a position has achieved hegemony when suddenly it feels that free speech is a much more moot proposition.
Yeah, know? Definitely.
That's clearly happened.
I mean, it is interesting because the people, you know, wanting to shut down Kathleen Stock, they will say, well, her position is the powerful one. We're defending the weak, the marginalized. Another factor that often you'll hear is people talk about safety. They say they feel they're made unsafe by her views, or, you know, one of the LGBTQ groups that were protesting against Stock said they were offering welfare resources to some of the kids who, you know, might struggle to cope with her views. Tom, what do you make of that angle? Because that's, you know, that seems to be the way to shut down debate, or hate is the other one, I suppose. No one comes out and says this should be censored. No one wants to own up to being against free speech or in favour of cancel culture. But there's always this other excuse.
There is always the other excuse. I've also found the arguments in favour of shutting it down so incredibly facile. I mean, you do wonder if they actually believe it themselves. So you see this argument, this isn't censorship, we're just demanding that this organisation rescind their invitation. And you think this is very, very strange. Or, you know, you talk about how Kathleen Stock has been hounded for her views, as Simon was saying, you know, essentially pushed out of her own university, not just protested against, but menaced her own chapter of a academic union, effectively turned against. All of these things are really significant. And people say, well, she's still got this massive platform, she hasn't been cancelled. And I only ever say that with a whiff of regret, as if to say we haven't been successful. So it's always...
Well, this week she resigned. I've been seeing a lot on Twitter. But didn't you know she resigned?
She got a bunch of death threats and then resigned. She did it entirely of her own volition. So all of this is ridiculous.
That is, I mean, you put your finger on it there, actual death threats, and certainly the very, very plausible threat of violence, which was, I've seen it myself on the walls of the underpasses around Tuscaloosa Uni, you know.
Stock out.
So it does make it absolutely despicable, in my view, that they then refer to safeguarding issues as the pretext on which to shut down this, the debate, and shut down the possibility of an event and so on. And we've seen it before with Ian Hirsielli, who had a whole tour in Australia cancelled because the Australian security could not guarantee her safety.
Yeah.
You know, that never happens to people on the left. Yeah. I can't remember the last time anyone, I don't know how hard left you'd have to be now. You would literally have to be Stalin reincarnated, I think, to sort of provoke actual violent demonstration. I think it's very cowardly, but they have learned, of course, because all humans are essentially is very sophisticated algorithms. You know, they do observe what happens, they do observe what works, and then they do more of that.
Yeah.
You know, they try the safety issue. They try a number of different prompts, and that seems to be the one that creates the effect they want, and so that gets repeated.
And people have been cowardly as well in not standing up to it as well. They found that difficult to speak
back. But, I mean, Constantine Kissin, who I don't know if you've ever had on here, but, of course, host of Trigonometry, very smart guy, he gave a speech. I think that might have been the Cambridge Union rather than Oxford. I can't remember for sure, but they're not that distinct anyway, in which he spoke out against, like, woke politics generally, but also, you know, climate change activism and so on, as not being what was going to change the world, because there were billions of people trying to claw their way out of poverty in China and India, and they were going to, like, determine the agenda. And it was very interesting to see how he spoke brilliantly without notes. He's got a lot of charisma and intelligence, and he carried the day. You know, inside the Oxford Union or Cambridge Union debating hall, it wasn't a problem. It wasn't like lots of shocked little snowflakes. You know, the kids there are actually perfectly capable of listening.
Well, that's something you always want to grab people by the scruff of the neck and say, you know, what do you think happens if you're offended? Do you think you're going to die?
Yeah.
You're going to piss yourself? You know, it's also not too bad.
It's not. And also, as you're saying, Simon, it's not a majority of students. I think a lot of them are kind of cowed into silence or just getting on with their university lives. But I think this is a point that even Kathleen Stock made in her kind of post-appearance write-up about it, is that the kids are all right, really. The problem is, as ever, is a very vocal minority dominating the debate. And I think, just as we were talking there about the fact that the justifications for censorship have changed, I think it's worth coming back to that, because they have, insofar as it's now this very safetyist, I hurt, therefore I censor, weaponize emotions and so on. But in a way, it has always been the same debate, really, just slightly different weapons applied to shutting down speech that they dislike. And it was so kind of striking because there's been a lot of kind of brow furrowing and confusion amongst kind of centrist sensibles. How do we get into this position where someone as eminently reasonable as Kathleen Stock could be censored? But that has always been the story, particularly of something like No Platform and British university campuses. Yeah. Almost as soon as it was brought in the 70s, it started to expand and expand and bloat and bloat. It went from just being fascist and racist groups specifically to individuals, Tory MPs, Zionists, Islamists were later added to the thing. And then suddenly all hell breaks loose and people say, what happened? What happened is you failed to stick up for free speech, and therefore, yeah, as it ever is the lesson of history, it spreads and spreads and spreads.
I remember I was at Southampton University in the mid-80s, and I would say it was fairly apolitical as, mm-hmm, as campuses go, but I do remember a chap called Harvey Proctor. I don't know if you remember him. So he was invited by a conservative club, and I'd never heard of him and not really engaged in politics at the time, but I was kind of petitioned, you know, we have to protest against this. And I do remember coming out and standing there. I was a complete sheep. I was just, you know, duped into doing it, you know, in order to win popularity. But I seem to remember Proctor was probably hard right. He was, mm-hmm, part of the Monday Club and so on, a sort of hard right, even by Thatcherite terms. And then I saw this slightly, you know, disheveled, sorry for himself, looking individual. And I do just remember thinking, my God, is that it? You know, I felt like we were one of those tribes that kills the boy with the club foot and then has a massive feast and, you know, dances around the fire. You know? This is pathetic. So I didn't get involved again. I remember another one where we went and barricaded ourselves around the local Tory party HQ in Southampton, but then rushed home so that we could watch ourselves on the 6 o'clock feast. You know?
Tom, before we move on, we kind of touched on this a little bit, but what is it about this issue, the trans issue in particular, that means that it, you know, it is the one where there are the biggest free speech?
Can I say something about that?
Of course, yeah.
Because I've been thinking about this a lot, because I talked to my wife about it, and she is genuinely puzzled, because she had always been a very tolerant person, and we live in Brighton, mm-hmm, there's lots of trans people.
Yeah.
There are trans kids at my daughter's school, and there was a trans woman who serves behind the till at Urban Outfitters that my wife sort of is quite, you know, attached to and stuff. How did it get here? And I have got a quite strong view about how we got here, which is that for many years, a good old-fashioned British fudge operated, basically. We were more than happy to pretend that you were a woman. Mm-hmm. We would use female pronouns. Mm. We would observe all the polite sort of gestures that would recognize your female status. But in return, the flip side is you don't attempt to get onto the university cycle team. You don't attempt to get into the swimming pool. Do you know what I mean? There are few points where we just go, let's just fudge it. Let's just pretend and we can all get along. You know, it's the escalation. It's pushing the last into the corners, mm-hmm, you know, and that is what has created it. Now, who has done that? I don't know. And who is benefiting from the sudden amount of heat and, mm-hmm, friction is a good question.
I guess, you know, self-ID comes on the scene around 2018,
roughly. You start to see things accelerate.
And that's when you see the debate.
But as people say now, the critical theorists say, if we lose the trans debate, if we lose the absolute conviction that trans women are women in every single regard, then the whole edifice comes down.
Yeah.
They're saying that in their own meetings, you know. Which I think is kind of sinister.
It is. And I think one of the things that has definitely shifted, because I think the mistake a lot of people make is to treat this, almost to treat the arguments of the opposition at face value and say that this is an extension of kind of gay rights politics or something like that. You know, gay rights politics wasn't intolerant like this. What's going on? I think the big shift that you saw, the difference between the LDG and the B and the T, as it were, was the fact that it shifted from this politics of kind of genuine liberation, of leave us alone, often fighting censorship to the ends of achieving their particular goals, to validate us, recognize us, reflect us back to ourselves, essentially indulge us often. And that's been a shift which isn't exclusive to trans politics, but ups the stakes in all kinds of ways. Mm. Because the existence of anyone on a university campus in your own family who just so happens in their own time to not actually believe that you are what you say you are, to, you know, not make a big deal out of it, but just in their own heads, not hold to the particular view that you have of yourself. That can't be tolerated if what you're seeking is constant recognition. But however we ended up here, it is fascinating that someone who is uttering a position, which is not just a view held by the vast majority of people, but when you're talking about the question of biological sex, is observable scientific facts. And that's heresy now. So however we got here, we definitely need to push back.
Spiked is looking for interns. We need people to help us to make our fresh, hard-hitting journalism that will reach audiences around the world. If you're an aspiring writer, editor, video maker, podcast producer, then this is the opportunity for you. So you have until the 16th of June to apply. And if you're successful, you'll be joining us here in our London offices for 6 months paid. Find out more about the scheme and how to apply by going to spiked-online.com/interns. That's spiked-online.com/interns. Best of luck. So believe it or not, we're now into week six of the Philip Schofield scandal. That's how long it's been since everyone's favourite daytime TV presenters were first taken off this morning sofa for a day under very mysterious circumstances.
Wow.
We now know last week, well, we all knew anyway, but it's been admitted last week that Philip Schofield had an affair with a younger colleague. Simon, what have you made of the downfall of St. Philip?
Well, again, as always, a lot of factors and strands that if one tries to disentangle them and speak coherently, there is a certain amount of schadenfreude, I think, isn't there, when any sort of overtly popular, slightly oily, I don't know, like mainstream sofa-bound presenter gets their comeuppance, because we all know they're all a bit too good to be true, you know, and they present this kind of shiny and, oh, that is that right, squeezy elbow, you know, and how did that make you feel? And it's all just a bit nauseating, you know. So I try to detach from that and just think, does he deserve the amount of, I don't know, kind of like almost Savile tier horror, you know. And I just don't think he does quite. I think the reality is, I think his own description of it is probably accurate. Unwise, but not illegal.
It's a great coinage, isn't it?
It could be
the name of someone's biography.
Yeah, absolutely. and until evidence to the contrary emerges, I think we have to conclude that's what it was, you know. But equally, I think it does expose that the culture behind the scenes and behind the cameras in those kind of TV shows is not quite what they present on camera.
Yeah.
And that in itself isn't actually a harmful thing to be reminded of, because it is a little bit like social media and the way we always go on Instagram and see everybody else's showreel and not the blooper reel. Mm-hmm. And you can think to yourself, oh God, I wish I was a nice person. So it's quite nice to see. I mean, I think, for instance, it's been quite interesting to see just how adept a player Holly Willoughby appears to be. She has actually, you know, a bit like Rishi Sunak. She has
knowing when to throw someone under the bus. That's a very important skill in these things. But it has been striking. First of all, how long it's been bearing on for. But you do feel that in a lot of the reaction, there's just that sense of, I don't know if hypocrisy is the right word, but because of the fact that it's not exclusive to daytime TV, but media in general, even more so than previously, it feels quite moralistic, often wants to present people as incredibly worthy. There was obviously all of the fanfare around Schofield coming out and that being a kind of great moral moment for the nation and so on. And so when you kind of fail to live up to these things, people, it makes the reaction, oh, of course they're up to that because they're human beings and they work in showbiz and these things always happen. But I think in particular, there was just this sort of sense of, in the context of Piers Morgan getting pushed out because he correctly said that Meghan Markle doesn't always tell the truth. All of the kind of Jeremy Clarkson nonsense that flares up from time to time. There was this kind of sense in which having a bad opinions were being punished more than bad behaviour. Or if where bad behaviour was being punished, as we've seen in recent years via Me Too or whatever, maybe it was being punished slightly selectively.
Yeah.
And I think in a context in which even our kind of popular media feels so moralistic and charged and virtue signaling, all these different things together, it raises the stakes for people like this. So you're less likely to forgive it as, well, that's just you know, people with their foibles, which are going to be particularly more pronounced amongst celebrities and people who make a lot of money.
I will say, though, also, I mean, that is, I think a lot of that is generated by the tabloid press. And I do think the mainstream press, I mean, the print, the legacy media, whatever you want to call them, they have been struggling for a number of years now. And one thing that they do in order to try and remain relevant and viable is they emulate social media. Yeah, so this, yeah. I mean, in an ideal world, this would be the kind of thing that would just be gossiped about on chat boards. Mm. But the press go with it because they can see that it's actually creating, and as you say, week six, I mean, it certainly doesn't justify that. It's obviously inflamed because they feel that they are telling you a story about the media ecosystem, which somehow elevates its importance itself, you know.
And the media loves nothing more than to talk about the media.
Exactly. And it was interesting, for instance, when the first Me Too kind of shockwaves went through Hollywood, the first thing Hollywood did was make a movie about sexual harassment in print media,
yeah.
you know, and news media, Fox News, and all that kind of, you know, they all like to kind of push it out and go, oh, it's not us, it's the, yeah. you know, yeah. there's a lot of hypocrisy working through the system there, mm-hmm. you know, and people are not going to turn away from it because it is salacious, it's slightly titillating, isn't yeah. it, you know. Mm.
And Tom, I mean, is there a bit of a free speech angle here? Because I don't know about you, but when I've been invited on TV, mm-hmm. You end up talking about this on pay-per-view or something because it's never off the news.
Yeah.
You know, we all knew what had happened.
Well, there was
we'd all heard the story, and you have to sort of, we had to do this sort of weird dance. I was sat next yeah. to Eamon Holmes, of all people, who was ranting about Philip
when
Schofield.
He had his viral
He had a rant, viral yeah. rant against him, but he still wasn't allowed to say he's had an affair with this mm-hmm. this.
Kim something yeah. who was the okay, from the like she'd been in the mm-hmm. Big Brother house, and she had made oh, yeah, a couple yeah, of very yeah. barbed comments on the sofa to him that people have gone, that's a bit odd. Yeah.
It was fascinating because you kind of had this conversation that was going on two levels at the same time. You had yeah. what you were able to say on television, what you would read in the tabloids. I think that was part of the reason that it went on for so long.
Yeah.
Because it was also the story had to be sustained to the point where either the injunctions fell away or someone came forward or there was something that the story could be kind of corroborated with and get around the various NDAs which were obviously being deployed in this particular situation. And the other thing is we don't even really know, because it's the nature of these restrictions that you don't really find out about them, you know, what injunctions such as they are exist under yeah. what circumstances, but and also what you've got to be very careful of saying given the sorts of laws we have in this country about what you can say about public figures and not be sued into the ground for. So it's another example of that, definitely. In a kind of
I think it was quite interesting. Somebody said on Twitter, it's not my world, I'm really, you know, just repeating second information, but this sounds plausible to me that it wasn't so much the NDA signed to ITV or even the super injunctions, it's the power of the agents. Agents are very, very powerful people in this game. And if they say to you, you know, if you don't protect our client, then you'll never get X, Y, and Z. I mean, my own agency is a large one in the comedy world. And I know that they, you know, they haven't in the past, you know, they exercise a bit of muscle. If you want him, you have to have him and vice versa. And it's quite interesting. Holly Willoughby herself, I think, left her agents and then sued her agents. There's been a big power play going on there. I believe Schofield being sacked by his agency was probably the decisive moment, even more
yeah.
than him being let go from this morning. You know,
well, I'd heard that Holly Willoughby, you know, got more flack for the Q incident than Philip Schofield, and a lot of people yeah. said that was to do with the row over the agency.
Yeah.
Let's move on to our final subject. It's got to get a bit more serious, I guess. rapid change of tone. The COVID inquiry. Mm. Then again, it is already turned into a farce. We've had rows over who, over what should be seen by the inquiry. Yeah. Mm. Boris Johnson has handed over his messages, all his WhatsApp messages, all his private notebooks. But the Cabinet Office, interestingly, which is representing the government, has so far, at the time of recording, it might change by the time you see it, but so far, they've refused to hand over his private information. Mm. I mean, Tom, that aside, there is a deeper political significance to this inquiry, isn't there?
Oh, of course. I mean, and you almost forget that it's supposed to be about the pandemic and yeah. the lockdown and everything, because it has very quickly descended into a kind of political jousting match between Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. I think Boris handing these messages in seems if more aimed at just trying to embarrass Sunak, force him to look cagey or whatever it might be, rather than anything else. But I think in a way, there's a bit of a salutary lesson about the fact that whilst it might have happened quite quickly, inquiries such as this often become farcical in the end anyway.
Yeah.
They're often presented as exercises in transparency, accountability, but often this is part of the reason they go on for so long, and as happens in this case, we've given such broad terms of reference, is that it allows a government to say, we're doing something, we're reflecting, we've got this judge-led inquiry. It will report about three governments after we're out of power. So this is even that kind of takes a lot of the heat out of the particular issue. And then even the kind of the amount of documents that we're talking about is a bit of a reminder of how broad this inquiry has been set out to be. So there's the usual things you would guess around what was the pandemic planning, how did they respond in the moment, what was the strength of the evidence, and so on and so forth. But then you also see things around institutional racism.
Yeah.
There's a lot of therapeutic stuff in there about how there's going to be a kind of national listening exercise that everyone can have their own grievances aired and their own kind of story spoken to. And then also, without wanting to sound too cynical, and they haven't held even a single hearing yet, you can't help but feel that the narrative, even kind of the conclusions, has kind of been pre-drafted, because the entire discussion around the pandemic, around lockdown, is why didn't they go in earlier? Why didn't they lock us down for longer, harder, etc.? And any kind of questions that I think really need to be asked around civil liberties. You know, we've had pandemics before. We haven't had lockdowns before. Surely that should be investigated. You know, are not going to be there. So I think if anything, I think it descending into farce so quickly has been a useful reminder of how these inquiries are often farcical in the end anyway. They're not about accountability, they're about butt passing, and they often very rarely get to the heart of the issue as it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, and Simon, don't we already know our view of the inquiry? I mean, for me and for Spikes, the biggest scandal is lockdown. For other people, the scandal will be the alleged lack of lockdown. I mean, I've quite understood that argument, but, you know, why do we need this exercise to tell us what?
Well, I agree with everything Tom said, and I'm a little bit older than both of you, and I remember probably even further back into inquiries that went back. I mean, obviously, Leveson was the phone hacking one, wasn't it? Before that, I can remember the name of the inquiry for the 2003, the
Chilcot.
Chilcot, right. And then even before that, I remember when I was at university studying law, the one came out, I think it was the Scarman report, which about policing in Brixton, which had led to the riots.
Brixton riots, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, none of these things have any impact. The Stephen Lawrence one probably had some impact on the culture in the Met, but even now we're finding out that the Met is still riddled with the stuff. It feeds into a sort of political biography culture, I suppose. At some point somebody will want to read it and kind of go, oh, that was interesting. I mean, a lot of us, if we're honest, do treat the whole thing like a soap opera. My wife actually worked for a communications PR department for the vaccine task force during the pandemic, which was a handy revenue stream when I was out of work. and I was sort of bringing her up cups of coffee and trying not to look at the screen where she had Dominic Cummings in the top right hand corner or whatever. But she would tell me stories that would turn your hair white about the inter-Nixine kind of squabbling, essentially, people trying to take ownership of good things and disavow bad things and anything that went wrong. Nobody's signature could attach to it. And it's a very human story. As it's been said so often as to become banal, but Westminster really was absolutely nailed by Iannucci's satire on it, and never more so than during that pandemic, I think. You're not going to find anything very useful because nobody like stuck their head over the parapet, you know. My sympathy really went to Boris Johnson a great deal. Everything that's been leaked about his response to it, which did seem to be inclined towards us, you know, as we share that libertarian view that not exactly let her rip, but more on that side towards rather than like what I think we just kind of bought the Chinese approach wholesale. It seems extraordinary to me. But as you say, before you start with these inquiries, there's always an anchoring moment where somebody gets the upper hand and the question becomes, why didn't we X?
Yeah.
Never why did we? What did we do and why did we do it?
Yeah.
But why didn't we err further on the side of X or Y? That's happened. And that's that. We're not going to change that now. And there'll be, you know, chat groups, and there'll be, I've got mates who are on WhatsApp messaging, you know, who are still absolutely persuaded that the clot shot is going to take action any moment now, and we're all going to keel over dead. You know, there are plenty of people whose minds have been, you know, probably permanently. And actually, I mean, I laugh about it, but I think some people have been really destabilized by it
because that's very true.
It was an extraordinarily vicious, unprecedented, and frankly unwarranted expression of state power, which is just not a very British thing. And I was appalled at how easily the British were led into it. I mean, I was really disappointed, you know, in us as a nation.
And what a fruitful inquiry, conversation, maybe not an inquiry for the reasons we've talked about, but you just feel like there's so much unfinished business from the pandemic and from lockdown in particular. The psychology of locking people up, as you say, the number of people of seemingly sound mind or relatively sound mind previously, you got dragged down one rabbit hole of another. The willingness of us all to go into that, the kind of atmosphere of fear that was created and how that was weaponized. And also the dreadfulness of the response. I mean, one thing that was really fascinating from the lockdown files, which I think in the space of a week was a lot more useful than this inquiry will be in the space of however many years it's going to run on, was just how unserious these politicians were, even in such a serious time. I mean, I heard Fraser Nelson talking about this recently on Spectator podcast. He was involved in the lockdown files. He's read every word of the Matt Hancock WhatsApp messages. And he was saying they weren't sharing massive papers. They were sending around to each other screenshots of graphs from Twitter. This is what decision-making was based on. We all remember that big shift from Witty and Valance being, again, kind of erring on the side of caution, erring on the side of we can't shut things down too much because how, you know, when are we going to open up and so on?
Here's some advice.
All of that just turning on a dime, essentially, under a moment of panic. And I think that's something that we've already got to see. But at the same time, I wish just generally in journalism, in media and public discussion, we focused a bit more on what the hell was lockdown about rather than who's to blame for this terrible crisis, which is all Boris Johnson's fault.
You remember the moment, I mean, if I had a single moment that like disgusted me really in terms of the media and their abdicating their responsibility to explain and clarify difficult decisions, it was the excitement they felt when they nailed Cummings and his and his trip to Durham. I mean, that became the whole story.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about Schofield. He was like that. He was the Schofield of that moment.
Well, one-man pandemic spreader.
And and I believe, I genuinely believe that was a kind of mass psychosis. Well, a mass psychosis, but it was a widespread hallucination where what they were seeing, what they thought they were seeing, was Cummings escaping the consequences of Brexit. They thought Cummings had created Brexit and then would abscond and go and live in a house in France and somehow be able to get away with it. And that didn't happen. And then they think he kind of would caused, you know, like he was responsible for the pandemic lockdown and everything. And then he got away with that. And so that it was a transfer of guilt or evaded guilt.
Kind of scapegoating.
Yeah. But like a Munchausen's by proxy, like a second cousin of scapegoating. So he was not being scapegoated for the pandemic. He was already to blame for Brexit.
Yeah.
You know, there was a massive hole there waiting to, anyway, that was my view. But it's the human interest thing. This is all the newspapers can do now. They have given up on trying to educate us or inform us on anything that is remotely abstract, that requires thinking, that requires subjunctive clauses. They have given up on that. And all they can do is erect, dummies, guys, effigies, and then encourage us to throw things at them. That's it.
Let's hope we get those horrible guys at the Inquiry. See them in jail.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.